Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on and grab your seat. You sitting comfortably? Then let's dive in. Yes, we're here. It's episode 3 of season 10 of the Two Shot Podcast. Just before we kick off, I'm recording this intro in a hotel in West London, and I'm sorry if sonically it's not as pleasing as normal. I'm having a few tech issues, and of course I'm flying solo, and you know, the main man, producer Griff, isn't here to sort things out. So if it isn't the best, then I apologise. But I tell you what is fantastic. It's episode 3 of the Two Shot Podcast with James Smith from Yard Act. Do you know Yard Act? Just pause this for a few minutes. Go search him out, however you listen to your music. Put in Yard Act. I nearly said Spotify, because that's what I do. Put in Yard Act. Listen to a few of their songs. And then come back. Or don't. You know what? Listen to this episode with James Smith, who is the lead singer of Yard Act. You're going to love it. He is... We've never met before. So I went to Leeds to meet him the day before we both pushed off to Glastonbury. And we met up in Leeds, in the sunshine, al fresco. Griff was there, which was brilliant. And we got down to it. He's good company. Very good company. I kind of went, oh yeah, I think we're going to be mates, aren't we? And yeah, we just sort of both felt like that. And met up in Glastonbury on the Saturday at their gig. If you were there in Glastonbury, Yard Act made two, well, they debuted on the Friday and then pushed another gig on Saturday. I was there at Williams Green at 6:25 on the Friday. And talk about a band coming out for their debut Glastonbury and grabbing the audience by the scruff of the neck and just telling everybody who they are. It was brilliant. Intelligent, funny. Everybody was just on the feet. I was, there was security guards at the back who I don't think knew who the band were, and they were just completely into it. So massive congratulations to Yard Act for their Glastonbury debut, because it was just fantastic. You're going to know more about Yard Act, about James, about who he is, about what he represents after this interview. What am I talking about? It's just a natter, and it was brilliant. I'm a huge fan of Yard Act. Their debut EP was brilliant. Their debut album has been put in. There was a piece in The Guardian a few weeks ago saying it's one of the top 20 albums of the year so far. I think it will make my list. I think it'll make everybody's list. They're touring at the moment. They're supporting. They've just supported Jack White after Glastonbury. They're everywhere. Go seek them. Hunt them down. Their live act is just brilliant. I mean, you're not going to, you know, you'll pause, catch your breath and go straight back in. They're brilliant. They're fantastic. And James was an absolute joy. Really lovely conversation. We did like an hour and a half. I think we could have done a lot more. I do love it, and it doesn't happen a lot, but when it does, yeah, I do love it when someone who I'm talking to asks me a question or asks me my opinion or thought or viewpoint on a certain topic or subject of what we're talking to. And James does this a few times, so much so that I have to stop and think. I don't want to dive straight in with an answer, but you'll hear it. It's great. I've been waffling far too long. This is episode 3 of season 10 of the Two Shot Podcast with Yard Axe frontman, the brilliant James Smith. Enjoy. I'll see you at the end. Maybe listen to this out in the garden in the sunshine, because that's where we were. See you in a bit. Have you been to Glastonbury before?
No. This is my first time.
Is it your first time as well? Because every time in the summer, because when you're acting, people don't acknowledge that you're a dad or there's summer holidays or there's half term. So I've just got to take the work when it is. And every summer, pretty much, I would have maybe a week off. And it's never been the time that Glastonbury's been free for me to go to, but this time it's like, oh, I've got 2 weeks off.
Have you had like rolled over tickets then, or have you?
No, you snuck in. Just sort of
got a friend.
Made some calls. But I'm going to, as we're recording this, I'm going tomorrow. But I'm going to set off like 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, wise.
Well, because it's that bloody train strike as well, which is just going to.
Are you driving?
But. The thing is, I've got to leave on Sunday because I start filming a new job on the Monday.
I've got to really take it nice.
Are you looking forward to it? Are you going to? We have a bit. As you know, you're playing twice, aren't you?
Yeah. We're doing two. Well, there was a few more potential ones, but we've decided to just make the most of being there and have a nice time. So my wife's coming. I've got a kid, and we're dumping him on his grandma. So it's the first time me and her have been away without him.
Because he's only young, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just turned one.
Right.
So, like, we're going to cut loose, got all the band, all their partners have come in, and our crew, and, like, other mates and management who are mates. Like, they're all coming down, and just want to make the most of it, really.
So you're going to see it both sides. You're going to see it as an artist, and you're going to see it as a punter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going to get stuck in.
What do you think do you have any sort of preconceived ideas about what the Glastonbury audience is going to be like? When you're on stage?
I don't know, because I watch it on telly when it's on.
Yeah.
And I always enjoy it on telly. And I don't know, like, I kind of love and hate festivals
I do know what you mean.
Desire and appreciate a large crowd in front of me, but I don't like crowds. So I kind of like standing near the back and sort of watching with space rather than getting stuck in. I used to when I was younger, so I don't know when that changed. When I was a teenager, I used to always be in mosh pits and that and crowd surfing.
I remember one of my first gigs and I was right at the front of Ned's Atomic Dustbin in Preston.
Nice, cool.
I had a band t-shirt on. It wasn't them. But I remember I was right up against the barrier and it was pressing on my chest. And forever after that gig, it just had a line there through the band t-shirt.
Because
so much pressure at the front. But now, I don't know, man, I'm 46. I don't want to be... What if I need to go for a wee? What can I do? I need to be at the back and get out.
Well, yeah, you used to be able to hold it in.
Not anymore.
No. And then I used to be comfortable just doing it in a bottle. And now I need to be near, you know, space and access to toilets.
Clean toilet, that. I mean, yeah. We're not going to see much of that, are we, really, to be honest?
Do you know what, like, as well, I always remember that. I used to go to gigs from the age of, like, sort of 13, 14 on my own. in Manchester.
Yeah.
And like you'd queue for the doors and you'd be in the top, in the first 30 people to get into the academy. And you'd run and you'd stand at the barrier and then nothing had happened for 45 minutes. And then three other bands would play and you'd stand through them all and then you'd watch the headliner play. And you'd have been there for 4 hours crushed without having a single drink.
Yeah.
Or any substances or any, or needing a toilet break. And you were, it was the happiest, I was probably happier then than I've ever been since, consuming performances and music. And I didn't need anything else. Whereas now I'm, yeah, struggle not to go to the bar within a set.
Yeah, it will stay at the bar, and but always nice to be at the bar. But yeah, I like an overview. I do like an overview. Yeah, and I like seeing, I took my mate's daughter was, she said, oh, would you take me to see Idols? And I went, I don't know, it's a bit noisy for me on a Saturday night. But anyway, I managed to take her. And we were up above and watching the crowd.
Right.
I said, I'm glad I'm not in there. But, I mean, they were fantastic.
Yeah.
They're really tight and she had a really good time.
Oh, that's ace. Yeah.
And then I took my son to his... He's been to festivals before with me.
How old was he? 11, you said?
It was just turned 11.
Is he into music?
Yeah, but he loves music that I go, where have you heard that? Because I'm not what... I don't want to be one of those dads that forces...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Taste on people, but he's just got into the Beatles.
Cool. Off his own accord?
No, they had a 60s day at school.
Right.
So all the food, they were having like vol-au-vents and cheese and pineapple on sticks, which he loved, weirdly.
Yeah.
And they were playing music and talking about the decade, and he went, yeah, I've really got into the Beatles. So now he just loves Eleanor Rigby. He'll just play it back to back.
Wow.
But I was telling him, and you'll probably know this better than me, I only just found this out, that John, I don't know if it was idea it was, but John asked Paul to write a song in his style. Do you know this?
Maybe.
John
not,
asked Paul to write a song in his style, and Paul said, right, well, you write one in my style.
Right.
So Paul ended up writing Why Don't We Do It in the Road?
Yeah.
And John wrote Julia about his mum.
Right, wow, I didn't know that.
I didn't know it until a few days ago.
That's quite interesting.
And then you listen to the songs with that in mind, and I'm sure somebody's screaming now listening to this going, you've got it wrong, but that's kind of the story that I've got.
Cool.
You listen to them, it sounds completely different.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's a great exercise. I should try that with other people.
But anyway, it's really... But his taste, he's broadened, like, he loves 80s music.
That Stranger Things doing that to him.
I think it is, but even though he's only just got into Stranger Things,
okay.
And we went camping and he met some other kids who were into it, so they all got on their bikes pretending they were in Stranger Things.
Nice.
And
very cool.
I just think, you're all right. It's good being a kid. Stay as a kid.
That's ace. Yeah. That's really cool.
How's being a dad changed things, like going on tour? Because, tell me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of where you're earning...
Money, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's really hard.
What, emotionally?
Yeah, yeah. It's physically, it's probably easier. I get more sleep, but like, it's I wish I didn't have to do it. Not for being physically away. But I mean, we've got a fairly good thing going with like Little and Often. You know, I come back. Anything if we're in the UK, anything that's North Midlands. Come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a strict rule, no longer than 2 weeks away if it's abroad. And this year, we just knew this year was going to be dialectic because it was album one and it was, you kind of got to do it. You know, it's when you kind of put your...
Well, especially...
Put your flag in the ground. So we kind of knew what we were...
Especially because things have just, certainly from my side, seems to have snowballed quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
During... Everything happening during lockdown, and then when was the album released?
January. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, we've turned down some pretty good stuff for next year already because it's just like, turned down going to Japan. Like, I was like, can't do it. Some things are more important.
Yeah.
And it's, hopefully there'll be another time I can do that.
But, yeah, of course. But the thing is, you can't rewind... That walk, or and then you sit.
she's videoed it for you. And, oh, look at what I want now.
Yeah. Well, I missed his first word, which was daddy.
Oh.
But then, you know, like, my justification of that is, like, you know, I could have been at work,
you could have been at the shops.
Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, I could have been out of the house when it happened and come back. So, it's pretty tough sometimes. We just had, like, we had 2 weeks in Europe and we'd planned, like, we had 2 days off either side of our show in Copenhagen. So I planned for him and my wife to come out and she got some, like, horrible, like, sickness the day she was meant to fly, and they didn't come, and it just meant it was the longest I've been away from them, and that was pretty fucking... I was in a bit of a sulk. I didn't leave the hotel room for the day.
Oh.
But then I'm not like, you know, you just got to get on with it sometimes. Yeah. And my ambition is to, you know, not be doing this by the time he starts school and be a lot more selective and, you know, do less for more later on. Because that's how it works. And also, I mean, you kind of know this in the industries we've ended up in. You make hay when the sun shines. You don't get to really choose, like, too much. You do a bit, but, like, and you can, and saying no to stuff is empowering, but there is a part of you that goes, you can't say no to all this because it's...
No, but it isn't. You know. I mean, whenever I talk to younger actors or even sort of actors my age, you know, it's taken me years to realise the power of saying no, and it is important to be selective, I think, from the word go. Because, you know... Japan ain't going anywhere.
So not. Yeah. No, that's it. Yeah, no. I mean, we do say no. Sometimes you have to say yes to some stuff
that
you would say no to because it's a job now. And
Do you see it as a job?
I see touring as a job. I don't see performing, and I don't see writing as a job because I love that.
Yeah.
And it's validated what I felt. Like, I'm 32 this year, so I've been chipping away at it since I was a teenager. I've always had this, like, mad sort of lack of confidence / complete self-belief in myself, where you think you're utter shit and then you think you're fucking brilliant and you believe that you've definitely got something, and so you don't give up on it. And that's probably why you're 30 years old starting a band again in a pandemic and, you know, and then all of a sudden it happens. But, like... When it started being the thing I do full time, I was like, yeah, I was right in my pursuit of this. My pursuit of this is what I wanted, and it kind of validated what I chipped away at all those years. But the fact that you do have to make your money touring, it's not the shows. The shows are great, but that's an hour of your day. It's the travelling. Yeah. Like, it's not. And people think you see the world, like, but you don't.
Well, it's like what you were saying when we started talking about Glastonbury. It's kind of rare. Because I'm mates with a few people in bands and they go, we're coming in and we're playing and we're fucking off again. We're not going to experience anything because we can't because the schedule's too tight.
That's normally
people flying and flying out.
Yeah.
So for you... And everybody in the band and the management and the partners and everything to have that time is going to be luxury.
Yeah,
you can treat it as a bit of a holiday, can't you?
Yeah. It's a well earned end of a phase for us. I think, and I'm glad that everyone's there. You know, it's going to be nice.
Yeah, well, because you've all experienced it together.
Yeah.
From what's been going on, haven't you?
And everyone tells me it's the best festival in the world. So it's got a lot to live up to.
I know.
I'm doing everything not to go in there, like, already, like,
dissing
it. Yeah, because I'm not like that much, really. But, like, sometimes you just feel like, is it as good as you're saying it is?
Go on, then.
It's like its own town. That's what people say. Yeah. Oh, right, is it really? Right, it's a dairy farm, isn't it? No, it's its own town and it's got its own culture.
It's got its own nightclub around that corner.
Yeah, this part only opens for 4 hours on a Sunday morning.
It's the secret path that you have to crawl through.
Yeah, yeah.
Come out the other end, but you're only allowed in if you've got a certain wristband, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm excited about all that. I'm just going to have a good time.
Yeah, I think I'm really looking forward to it. And do you know what? When we're filming now, look, if the weather stays like this, happy days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be good.
James, when people and fans are buying tickets to your shows and you're headlining, it's one thing, right? Because they've bought the tickets to come and see you. But when you're supporting another band, they've come to see the headliner, aren't
they? Yeah.
Do you and the band sort of approach that differently when you get on stage? As opposed to your own gigs?
Yeah. It's a different. You have to reset your ego and you have to win the crowd over. And it's, I like the challenge of it. That's why I like playing festivals, because as much as there might be a handful of people that have come to see us, there's a ton of people who will just wander up, and a ton of people have heard the name or have listened to a song but haven't seen it live. And it's like being a salesperson. You're kind of pitching your style and showing what you're kind of capable of. And I get a lot of joy out of it, and I like doing slots that aren't our own, because you can't. When you're doing your own, now we're at a point where when we do our own headline shows, we can kind of lean on the audience a bit to do the work as much as we do it.
And I think they want to
as well. Yeah, which is handy for us when we're knackered. But I love it. I love the challenge of it. Like we did a couple of spots in Blackpool, actually, with Foles.
Yeah.
And
lovely venue.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, that was like when they sort of said, do you want to support us, and which of these do you want? And we picked Blackpool, and the management's like, you sure you don't want to do 4 nights in London with them instead? And we were like, no, we want to do Blackpool.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right, if that's what you want. So we were like, right, we'll do Blackpool. And yeah, the venue was gorgeous. And, you know, I've got a lot of fond memories of Blackpool growing up, so I didn't know in what other capacity we'd play Blackpool unless we become as big as Foles and can sell out 2 nights at the Empress Ballroom, which I can't see happening. But they're a great band, but their crowd is probably fairly different to ours.
Well, very different styles.
Yeah. And testament to them for the supports they picked for that tour, because they really they went out of their way to sort of champion sort of newer bands and it was all their choices. Like, they handpicked all the sports, which is always ace when a band do that.
Does a band always do that?
We do that. But, I mean, I don't know. It's probably, it depends. Like, sometimes it's like management will be like, or labels will be pushing acts if there's, vested interest in them. But we always pick our own, But
and do you champion sort of up-and-coming new bands?
Well, yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, of course we do. Yeah.
Can you feel it from the crowd? You know, when you start to win them over, is there something you can feel? You go, oh, I think we've got them now.
Yeah. There's a turning point. Yeah. And it's... Yeah, you just have to work harder, and it's really funny. Like, some bands are ace, and they just do what they do, and they just... It's like they're in their lane, and it's like you're with them or you're not, and they'll go up against a crowd that's not their own, and they won't adapt or shift any part of themselves or their music to appeal to anyone else or their personalities. And that is like, that's ace, that's what they do, and that's why they have such a... That's why those bands have a defining sound and an aesthetic and an image that won't shift, whereas... You can kind of play with the psychology of people and kind of shift an audience's perception of you by just sort of toning a little bit down or amping a little bit up, or, giving them a bit of gratitude and then giving them a bit of shit. It's quite a psychological thing, I think. It's a fun game to play because... Yeah, winning people over, it's not as easy as... I mean, if you do what you do and you're good, you'll win over a certain amount of people. Yeah. Other people won't be into it. I mean, I don't know, maybe this analogy doesn't work, actually.
No, I think it does, because, I mean, I don't do loads of theatre, but I was telling my girlfriend the other day when we were doing a play years ago, it was just before my son was born, so it was like 11 years ago.
Right.
And we'd moved to the West End. There was very little press and publicity. People didn't really know we were there.
Yeah.
And when you're doing a matinee show, it's the Blue Rinse Brigade, and they're all there. They've been forced to come. And you can sense it as well, going, we've totally not got them.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
got them here. Yeah. And then I remember looking down at one point, there's three people fast asleep on the front row. It's like, what's the point? We might as well just clock off now. It's just not, you can't win that back at all.
Yeah.
So, no, I think you're right. I think you do feel it.
It's just if you're up for the challenge, I guess. I guess for theatre, it's... I don't know, it is, you know, there's only so much you can do as well. It is energy. But you can, it's how you sort of, I sound like a fucking right hippie saying this. It's how you interpret the sort of energy in a room, and if you can sort of, how do you convert that energy into something positive that's going to make people feel what you're doing when they're not already feeling it. And it takes a lot. It takes three, even with our own crowds, it takes three songs before people are moving. Like, you have to put that groundwork in, you know. It's
really, because like, I think most of your stuff's really good to dance to. I would have thought they'd be there at track one.
It's some bigger shows, yeah, but sometimes, you know, smaller venues, you know, the bigger the room, the bigger the amount of people that are going to dance, the faster they're going to do it. But I think in smaller venues, there's a smaller pocket of people and everyone's a bit unsure about whether it's going to go off or not.
And a bit self-conscious.
Yeah, you have to kind of amp them up and, yeah, there's an art to it.
You mentioned before about when you were a teenager about tinkering and writing. So when did all that start for you? Or was it something you'd always done? But I suppose when did you start taking it seriously?
Music, writing.
Yeah. Because I feel if we took all the music away and we were just left with the lyrics, you could quite easily stand there on a stage and tell these stories.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I remember writing my first set of lyrics in primary school. I didn't play any instruments, so I didn't know how music worked, but I remember writing verses and choruses. Even, you know, I kind of knew enough about pop music to write and to rhyme. That was always something that I liked to do, and was like this, like, you know, two like stanzas, like two and two.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. And then it was like, and then I'd write chorus, and then it'd be like verse two. And I don't know where I picked that up from, but I remember writing that young. And then, yeah, when I was a teenager, I remember like being in bands with mates and you try and write originals and like, you know, I was always the drummer and obviously the singer would always write the lyrics and they just never really gelled. And then I think, yeah, it was like Arctic Monkeys. Like, I started writing in that style as a teenager because I understood it.
And, yeah.
And so I was like, well, you can write about these things and, you know, you'd, yeah, just write about, you know, going out to nightclubs in Warrington. Like, it's really fucking embarrassing. But it was a start. And, then when I got to... When I got to uni in Leeds, I didn't play any instruments. I went to music college and I didn't play any instruments. I did a production course.
Right.
Apart from drums, I played drums, so, but I didn't have any melodic, I didn't know how to write a song with a guitar or whatever. So I used to just write quite rhythmically and write beats and then write words to them. And.
But you were kind of still just on your own, right?
Yeah, never really. Yeah, I mean, I wrote lyrics in the band I was in at a teenager back home that I didn't sing and was kind of finding my feet with it. And then I kind of just got this confidence when I came to uni, when I went to the College of Music and I found a band there.
Because you were sort of around like-minded people there, do you think?
Well, because I wasn't, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't really... I found a few people that I ended up forming a band with, which was called Post-War Glamour Girls, which I did for like 10 years. which also is a John Cooper Clarke poem. So yeah, that's probably wearing my heart on my sleeve there. Like, he was quite a big. I think when I remember my dad gave me his CDs, and I remember being like, all right, that made more sense to me than a lot of the poetry I was told I couldn't do poetry at school. I was told I didn't understand it by my English teacher.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And so I gave up on that quite fast, and I thought it wasn't for me. And so it's something I still carry with me now, actually. I think actually what I do is poetry, but I struggle to say it is because I was told that I was doing it wrong as a teenager. And so I was like, all right, well, that's, you know, I got a C for that. I'm not really doing it right. I won't interfere on that anymore. Like, it's clearly not my world. It's funny how those things stick with you, isn't it?
Yeah. But, it's just the little things that somebody says. Because as much as you can have encouragement by, you know, say a teacher, it's only the other teacher goes,
yeah, yeah,
no, actually, this is how it's done.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
You can't go outside this box. Yeah, which is complete bullshit.
Yeah, it's bad.
And destructive for a child.
And I imagine now, 15 years on, with the state of things now and sort of standardised testing and that, it's probably 10 times worse. I imagine that way more creativity is crushed out of kids that are having a go than, you know, would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, I've just been watching that. Have you watched Pistol on Disney Plus?
I'm 3 episodes in.
You are? All right. So you've seen the, you know, when Johnny Rotten auditions for the band.
Yeah.
And they all laugh their heads off at him. And I was kind of like, as well as watching it, I know some of it's like semi-fictionalised or whatever, and the sort of structure's bent a little bit and all that, but started reading up again on the Sex Pistols, sort of looking at the backstory and looking at John Lydon's sort of story and looking at instances where, like, you know, he was kind of just like knocked down or knocked back, and that was one of them. And I was just thought, I mean, like, obviously he's a very defiant person who went on to become Johnny Rotten and be John Lydon and always have his own fucking voice on everything. But it just, like, made me think, like, how many times are, like, the kids give it a go and then someone laughs at them or tells them they're shit and they never do it again? And it's like, what are we, you know, imagine if, you said this one of them hypotheticals, isn't it? Imagine if Johnny Rotten had thrown the towel in then and how the catalyst for everything would have been different.
Yeah.
You know, I know it would have been someone else if it wasn't him, but it's just interesting, those subtle things that we can carry with us. And a lot of people, just a lot of kids just knock back very young and then never
amount of people that I've spoken to in the past, certainly over the 5 years, and not even just on this podcast, just like in normal life. And they were told, when they said to a careers advisor at school, oh, you know, I want to be an actor, or I want to be a musician, or I want to write. You know?
Yeah.
That's all very well and good, but what's your main career going to be? That sounds like a lovely hobby.
Yeah, yeah, it is, that, isn't it? Yeah.
How many poor kids have just gone, oh, well, maybe I should listen to this person? Well, no, actually. Yeah. You should follow what you're doing.
Yeah, it's not really what. Yeah, for you. it's funny, isn't it? It's weird. It's, but yeah. Hang on, what was I saying? I got distracted. Sorry.
We all get distracted. We were talking about that cartoonist, though. Just going back to the pistol thing, and it's quite.
Yeah. I'm quite enjoying
it's quite
it.
Theatrical,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
It is, yeah.
But I think they're all going with that style. And it works.
Yeah, I think it works. I think I'm finding it enjoyable.
And it rattles along.
Mm.
Like, it's really well paced because fucking Danny Boyle, and he's good.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a really good director.
I think it's good. I know there's been a lot of backlash from it, but I think it's just campy and quite fun. And who cares if it's slightly made up? You know.
But also, it's that's sort of one person's version of a story. Yeah. So I've said this to before, but, you know, the amount of people that said, oh, yeah, I was there at the trades club.
Yeah, yeah.
When the Sex Pistols put, and you weren't, because there was only a very small crowd there.
Yeah, yeah.
Very claims to have been there.
It's funny, that.
It's all right with that story, though. I think that pistol thing, I think people just dive in and go with it, and it's a lot of fun. It's a good fun ride.
Yeah, it is a fun ride. I'm enjoying it. And, yeah, it is good. It's good. I like it.
But let's just nip back to uni again. That was when everything started to sort of click into place a little bit for you.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I went to the College of Music because I wanted to get out from under my mum's feet, and I knew that I wasn't going to... I mean, like, when I did my A-levels, I did all my pretend subjects, like theatre and media and English and music tech. And I knew that I wanted to start a band, and there weren't that many people in Warrington, and I wanted to start my own life and not be in my mum's house, and basically just didn't want to have a job. Yeah. So I just, you know, got in on this production course and spent 3 years learning not a lot about music production, but spending a lot of time using the facilities and making friends with a lot of people in Leeds who played in bands and forming a band, and that in itself felt like my education.
Yeah.
And you know, and yeah, utilising the library, all the CDs and the books and that, and just getting as much out of it as I could. It you know, it wasn't really a 3-year course. There's not too much you can say apart from learn how to do it and use your brain, and most of it, you know, most of production is learning how to manage people and manage egos, I think, more than it is about plugging wires in. And so I was doing that, and I, you know, started this band, and confidence kind of grew in that, because I saw myself, with it being a music college and there being like jazz courses and classical courses and rock and pop courses and then the production course, the production kids tended to be the ones who were a bit shitter on instruments and weren't trained in the same way. They were, you know, they were coming from they'd done music tech at A level kind of background, which was like, at the time, it was like you'd have Cube. Do you know Cubase?
No.
Cubase is like, I mean, it was great. It was like sort of archaic sort of version of Logic or Pro Tools, like one of the first versions that our school kind of had on a computer, and you'd draw these triangles in on a grid to make drum beats and that. It was quite cool, and we were kind of coming from that and like learning that kind of side of it. And but you know, also had guitars and was sort of picking up and learning, and yeah, started this band with these people that are, you know, some of my best friends still. And kind of learnt as we went, learnt how to write songs, learnt a lot about myself and what I wanted. I was quite...
How old were you at this point?
19 to 22, I was at uni.
Right. And so you've been a lot of growing up personally within that time, as we all are at that age.
Yeah. I think I did most of my growing up sort of the ages, sort of, yeah, probably like, yeah, sort of into my mid-20s. I was quite, I was just really fucking angry at the time. I was miserable. I had a fair bit going on in my personal life that, you know, I lost a friend at 19, and I never really processed that. And then some other stuff going on with that I won't go into, but like that I realised that I kind of dealt with by pretending it was fine. And like looking back, I definitely kind of just swallowed it down and didn't really sort of face it head on. And then I kind of did over time. And yeah, I just kind of learned a lot about myself through writing, really, and that kind of led me to sort of that band sort of ending in a fairly good place after four albums, but to not much, to very little success. But
is that why you parked it?
I think some of the others were ready to move on with their lives, and you know, one of them is a sommelier now.
Right,
is that a wine taster? They're wine pairer. They're, one's a sommelier, one's training to be a music lawyer, and the other is like a manager for like a music shop and that. So that, but you know, they were hitting a point in the. It's a lot to ask of people. It takes up a lot of time to play an empty room.
Yeah,
and I got it, but I would have carried on.
Would you have?
I would have. Yeah, I mean, I did with a new band. Yeah. Like, you know, it's something in me that I couldn't give up, and fuck knows why. But I carried on. I started a new band straight away called Cruel World that did nothing, but I just loved the songs we were writing, and it was like the most mellow. Like, Post War Glamour Girls was quite angry.
But that's probably because you were quite angry. Quite probably, yeah.
So the other thing was, as it started coming to the end, I started to come out of this sort of phase that I'd been in, and I started to feel like I couldn't really deliver the songs anymore. I couldn't really. I also had that very. I think it's largely like quite a naive thing that I feel that only musicians have, no other, like the tortured artist thing. Like, they really struggle to think that you can do anything if it's inauthentic unless you're feeling it in that moment. And it is bollocks. Like, yeah. But at the time I was like, I can't scream this song anymore because I'm quite happy. And that's how it kind of felt. And, but yeah, we parked it in quite a good place, and I was like, this isn't really the music kind of making now. But then I kind of went too far the other way and started making this really sort of like soft Americana, like alt country indie rock with some mates who are still all mates, and I'd love to pick that project up again at some point when I'm not as busy with this, just for complete sheer love of it.
Yeah.
But with that, I felt like because I kind of poured so much of my sort of personality into Post-War Glamour Girls and got nothing from it, I felt like there was something wrong with me a little bit, and that people didn't want me, but I still kind of like believed in the writing I was doing. So with this band...
You took it personally?
Yeah. I just thought like, well, no one wants to hear me going on. So when I wrote these songs, I got somebody else to sing most of them. And like, and when I sang, I like sucked all the sort of character out of my voice and sang them in like the most monotone, like the plainest voice I could, because I didn't want to like offend anyone almost, like
which is quite the opposite to what you're doing now, because there's so much character there.
Yeah, and then that was like, I don't know, I don't think I would have got to the point that I got to with Yard Acts if it wasn't for, first off, Ryan, who I started the band with, encouraging me and like reassuring me that just talking in my own voice was all right. And then after that, just the reaction it got, you know, when it did all right on Six Music and that, and it was like, oh, people actually... And then when it became gigs with people at them, it was like, oh, people just think, they just like what we're doing. And then it's, again, it's that thing I was saying, like, going back to what we were saying earlier, when you kind of shot down, how many people are shot down don't achieve what they could go on to achieve. It was that, as soon as I knew people, I had the wind in my sails, I started pushing it further and feel like now I'm starting to reach somewhere I want to be with it, more so than what we've already achieved. And I feel like I couldn't have done that without support, which is pretty mad, really, because it makes you feel like you're quite, you know, what's the word? Do you know what word I mean?
No.
Like your ego is malnourished or something, if you feel like you can't do it unless you're getting credit and support for it and praise. Like, you feel like you can't do something about praise. But I don't know if that is the case. I just think people just excel when people tell them they're doing all right, you know.
But also, you must know, you must feel it as well, going, oh, we're onto something here. This feels like a part of me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there must be something that very exposing when you go, well, I've written this and now I'm going to put this out there and see what the reaction is.
Yeah, it's scary, yeah.
Yeah.
It is scary.
Do you think you need to be scared?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, everyone's got to be a little bit scared if they're being truly vulnerable.
Exactly, which I think is key to being vulnerable. I think, and also I think there's a strength in vulnerability.
Yeah.
But there's nothing worse, that's a silly statement, but I don't like seeing anybody, actually, whether they're a musician or an actor, I'm just taking those two because that's what we do, on the stage, and you go, you're looking from an audience point of view, you go, you couldn't give a shit.
Mm.
You don't care.
Yeah.
So it's either an actor who comes on the stage and he's just pissing through it, he just wants to get back.
Yeah.
Or it's a band that are so bored with their set, they're just...
How often do you see that when you're watching other actors? Percentage-wise.
I don't want to say I might offend people. Quite a fair bit. Although I will say, we went to the theatre twice last weekend in London. So we went to see a play called Jerusalem.
You're going
to
give away now by naming the plays.
No, this is all very good.
All right, okay.
So there's a Jez Butler's play called Jerusalem that's just come back after like 11 years.
Right.
Do you know, have you heard of this play?
No, I haven't.
I think you should read it. You'd really like it. Cool. So there's an actor in it called Mark Rylance.
Okay. I know that name.
Well, I was on the phone to a friend driving up to Leeds today because he'd seen it as well.
Right.
And we were still talking about it like 4 days after.
Cool.
Because we were going, right, we sat up one night in this hotel. We were on the Saturday night.
Yeah.
Going back to it.
Yeah.
And then go, what about the ending there? What did that mean? That was quite ambiguous. Right. What do you think? Oh, no, I thought this. So you sat there having these discussions. Yeah. But that is quite the opposite of what I'm talking about. You see somebody come on stage and just take complete control over what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were alive. I know that sounds that sounds silly to say, but you just went, oh, that's not Mark Rylance, it's the actor. This is this character who's just come out of this caravan.
Yeah, yeah.
He's washing his hair in this steel... He's got a massive hangover, he's cracking eggs and vodka into it, and he's drinking it on stage, and you feel the energy from the audience going, oh,
yeah.
We were here, we're going to remember this.
Oh, cool.
And then on Saturday night, we went to see Oklahoma.
Nice.
But it was a complete retelling.
Right.
Really dark. It was the bleakest ending to anything I've seen.
Right, okay, cool.
By the time this comes out, it's over anyway. But like, they're all covered in blood at the end.
Wow.
It was like it turned into a fucking Pedro Almodovar film or something.
Right.
It was fucking brilliant. And then even after that, we were still talking about that as well, going, because it's just an old school musical where everybody's shining happy.
So they still have the songs in it? Was it done as a play or was it done
still
as a musical?
Still the songs.
Right, okay. But
one of the actors has got a guitar on stage because he's a bit of an actor muso. It was brilliant. Right. But they're all sat on stage. It was kind of quite Brechtian. They were all sat on chairs.
Cool.
It was very sparse. It was almost like a school hall, like an American gym.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all in modern day sort of cowboy costume, you know, country and western sort of style. But at the end of it, after 2 days after it, I went, you know, that lead character is supposed to be really nice. He's a horrible piece of shit. he was so narcissistic. Why would anybody want to be with him? And also, wait a minute, he went round to that other fella's house to talk to him about his funeral, about how he probably should kill himself. It was horrible. But it was only when they'd sort of stripped everything away and he went, this is quite a dark musical where no real characters, any redeeming features at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So no, that...
Obviously, that sounds ace. Actually.
It was a really special thing to see. But
that's
because we were so blown away and still processing the night before.
Yeah, Mark Rylance, you said.
Yeah, but and they were both brilliant. But
I've seen him in anything. I feel like I know the name.
So he excels at everything he does. I think. Right. I think he's brilliant, and he says to himself, you know, he feels at most at home when he's on stage, and you can tell because it's, you're witnessing something quite extraordinary. But he, I think it was after the first bit of Jerusalem when it played out, he did a couple of Spielberg films like back to back, and then like I think he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Bridge of Spies. He's great on screen.
Yeah.
But he's so, it's just quite an odd fish.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
You buy it, you buy everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the complete opposite of what we were kind of just, I've just kind of derailed it. But
No. Well, no, it's interesting because, well, I mean, the thing that a lot of modern, I'm doing quote fingers here for the podcast, quote unquote post-punk bands, as the press likes to call us, is that for a lot of them, it's their aesthetic to look bored on stage, so you can't really tell if they're into it or not, and that's part of the poker face of it, really. So I don't often. I mean, you can, but no, you can feel it through the music whether a band is stock still. You can feel when a band fakes it as well.
Yeah, well,
so like I say, it's just an energy, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like when someone's being a tryhard. But also, people have different opinions of what a tryhard is. And some people might think, I'm a tryhard because I leap around on stage trying to get people amped up. But,
We'll have that. I knew we'd get some. I knew we'd get lovely garage tryhard. But that's the thing as well. You can see it. You can see it when someone's faking it.
Yeah.
I can. Yeah. But I can hear it when someone's faking it.
Yeah.
This comes back to listening to the radio. You know, when someone's really trying too hard as a DJ on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Just tone it down. Just relax a bit more. Be natural. And also, you don't find that interview funny. You're laughing there, and that's the fakest laugh I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
You can just hear it.
Interviews are hard. You get a lot of interviews where you know that the person isn't, especially at festivals, you get shoved in front of someone to do an interview and they don't even know who you are, and then they've clearly been given a rundown.
And they're not even listening to your answers anyway.
Yeah, and you just think, wow, who's this for? What are we doing this for? But, it's funny, isn't it? I'll tell you what, here's something interesting. How do you feel about... So, we're talking about... I think we've basically what we've said in a roundabout way, would you agree, Craig, is that... People believe you when you be yourself, right?
Yeah.
Right. But as an actor, you're always being somebody else. Uh-huh. So how do you be yourself whilst being somebody else completely?
Well, I don't think you are. I think you're being true to yourself as an actor without getting all wanky, for the art form, right?
Yeah.
But your investment is in the character.
So you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
So that's you being yourself.
Honouring the script.
Yeah.
And creating the character into three-dimensional sense.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That's great.
But I also see, talking about people faking it on whatever they're doing on the stage, if you're there in a live capacity, is people who are technically brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But... they're showing you how technically brilliant they
are. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't like that.
No, it's boring, isn't it?
Yeah, it's boring. Yeah. It's exactly that. It's not exciting at all. So just jumping back to Mark Rylance on the stage. You did not know what was going to come out of his mouth.
Yeah, cool. Right. Yeah, yeah. The energy and the suspense. Yeah, yeah.
And it's slightly terrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're sat there.
Yeah.
With all strangers.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're all like that. You're just waiting to see what happens next and what he's going to come out with next. And I like seeing that in, as I say, whatever capacity we're in, whether it's a band or we're on stage or we're seeing something.
Yeah. Where do you stand on the podcast as an art form?
I think conversations in general... are sacred. Like, we're having... I don't want to give it too much weight or sound like an idiot, but I do think so, because we're having this conversation now.
Yeah.
It's never going to be repeated.
Yeah.
But what I've learned... because I was terrified doing this, because... and I've said this before on the podcast, but what... certainly I can't speak for every actor, but what I always hated was the selling... of the product.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I had to go on and do a live interview or a phone interview...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're getting... it's a bit like you at festivals, you get asked the same questions. They don't really know who they are. They haven't seen it. But I was always terrified of being me.
Right. Yeah.
Because you just try and hide as much behind.
Yeah. Well, because you want to keep your private. You want to keep your personal self to yourself. You want to keep a part of you not exposed as well, don't you?
Yeah, again, and that's sacred. But it's not just for the sake of you. It's for other people and loved ones in your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Even more so, probably, because at least you build up strength and you've got tools to deal with it, whereas people aren't asked to be in this, might be affected, you know? Yeah, it's happened to me in the past.
Yeah.
But when I started this, it was like, well, I've got to... Listening is my job as an actor, but this is very different because I've got to be myself because I can't fake it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that won't be true to me. Forget about being true to a character, that won't be true to me. So therefore, it won't be authentic.
Mm.
So I was just constantly learning to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's still a buzz and it's still exciting.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't carry on doing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's great.
It's nice. I don't, and I've said this before, so forgive me, I'm repeating myself, but I don't think we have proper one-on-one conversations enough.
No.
You know? Do you have those mates where, oh, no, I'm going out with A because it's just me and them and that's our relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got other mates where, well, we all get together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I do have those mates. And, those conversations are sacred.
They are, aren't they?
And, sometimes it's hard to find the time these days, you know. Well, I mean, you know. Yeah. I mean, my own wife is one of them mates and we find it hard to find the time at the moment to just sit down and back and forth. Like, yeah, when you get lost in a conversation... And you don't know where it's going, and
that's as exciting as seeing something on the stage. And you're going, I don't know what's coming out of the mouth because we don't know.
We're not
planning it.
That's nothing, it.
That's why it's just me and you now with some cup of tea and a mic. I've got no list of questions because I never want that.
Yeah, of course.
Because I wouldn't be listening.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be looking. Yeah. And I think they're the two important things that I've learned.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's been interesting so far. Who knows where it'll go next?
I'm sure it'll probably go downhill now after that, mate. But let's talk. Let's get into it. Let's talk about building Yard Act. How did it all get together?
So, Ryan, who I started the band with, me and him had been. He was in another band called Menace Beach, knocking around Leeds, and we'd played some gigs together and stuff, and we were friends, and we were kind of going to the pub a little bit.
Yeah,
and that came to an end, and he basically ended up needing somewhere to live, and I said, "Do you want to just come and stay in our spare room?" And he was up for that, and so he moved into our spare room, and. He was going through a tough time. I think he's sort of on the right track again now, but, you know, I think that really bound us, him coming to live with me and Lynn's, and, like, looking after, you know, getting himself back on track. And it was in that time that we started writing...
Together
for a side project.
Right.
And...
Unaware of what this side project was going to be?
No, there was no grand plans at the time, and there was a couple of like other lads knocking around that had sort of said they wanted to start a band, and so we kind of sort of set that up. And it was it was called Yard Act, and we did a few gigs with it in the start of 2020. So that was like September 2019 to December 2019. Ryan was at my house and we were writing demos. And then he moved out on New Year's, on like the 6th of January or something. And we did our first gig on the 6th of January, he moved out on the 5th. And we did our first gig here,
right,
at Brudenell on the 6th, opening for our mate's band, Big Softy. And we got two more under our belt before the lockdown hit. We had one track recorded, which we'd done with Bill Ryder Jones.
Yeah.
And Ryan's, we had like a decent manager straight away because Ryan used to be on a label called Memphis Industries, if you know it.
I know.
We've got
it,
like
yeah.
Field Music and Mush and the Go Team and that. And so they took us on early and they sort of said like, right, let's put this song out. And we were like, well, shouldn't we wait until we can all go out again? And they were like, it's probably best to just get it out and see what happens. So we put it out during the lockdown.
Was that Fixer Upper?
No, that was Trapper's Pelts, that was called. Right. So that came out, and there was a little bit of a bubble and a murmur, and that was really nice, but, you know, it didn't really mean much. And then they were like, well, you know, there's kind of a bit of interest off record shops. If you can get a B-side done, we can press a 7-inch and kind of get the ball rolling with them because they kind of want to support you. And so Fixer Upper was a demo that me and Ryan had that wasn't finished as far as we were concerned, but we sent it to Ross Orton, who did like Working Men's Club and Arctic Monkeys and stuff. He was like a producer. Then we sent it to him to do a remix just to mix it, and he essentially just like turned everything up and made the drum kit sound enormous. And like, and it was like my vocal day. It was the first vocal I'd done of it. Like, there's loads of pops on the vocal and loads of me like slurring words and like and stumbling and stuttering because it was like the first take I'd done of that. It was a demo. And that came back and it was just meant to be the B-side to this other song. And then it kind of all just took off after that. And it was mad. And we lost a couple of members in the process. They had another band going and, you know, they kind of chose to go with that. And we had a new guitarist, Shippo, come in, but we didn't see him because of the pandemic, so he was recording remotely. And then, like, it was all kind of building without any gigs. And
also building without, like, forging, like, proper relationships.
Yeah, really.
Doing
weird.
All the
yeah.
things that you would normally do.
Yeah, completely. Apart from me and Ryan,
we
were very, very sort of bound together at this point and we're kind of... That kind of just kept growing stronger and stronger. And as this grew, kind of our relationship grew in tandem with it. And it was all really, there was never one point where we weren't on the same page. And that was quite sort of refreshing in a band. And then it got to the point where like labels were sniffing around and stuff. And we went down to Bristol for a week in January 2021. With this producer Ali Chant, who did the album, to see what would happen, because we were just trying stuff out. We didn't have a label at this point. We didn't know what we were going to do next.
Were you recording in Bristol?
Yeah, near St Paul's. His studio is. Do you know it?
I used to live not far from Bristol. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's wicked, isn't it?
Yeah.
We had a good time, except everything was closed.
Yeah.
It's probably why we focused on the album instead of getting distracted, really, which was quite nice. There was not a lot to do. We just stayed in this Airbnb, walked to and from the studio every day. And it was just me and Ryan. Sam didn't come because of lockdown restrictions, and he sent all his parts remotely. And I ended up playing drums on the record because we didn't have a drummer at this point. And we basically just built the skeleton of the album in a week with Ali, me and Ryan. And then he came up to Leeds for a week and we recorded with my mate Rob and Ali there producing, with Sam playing all his guitar parts. And we finished the record in Leeds at a local studio called Greenmount in March. Still didn't have a label, didn't know what we were going to do with it. But we're talking to quite a lot of labels. And then Ireland kind of like kept coming back, and they were the ones that kind of got where we wanted to go with it. And they took the album as it was.
At that moment, before you were with a label, you're doing all this stuff, you're recording, you're in the studio. Who's financing all of this?
Ourselves,
right?
The previous...
Because that can't be cheap. Studio time must be...
Studio time, Ali was pretty chill about saying, like, you know, pay when you can. And we got funding from PRS as well to do the album. So that covered that.
Right, okay.
But everything else, it was like the first bit of press. Yeah, mine and Ryan's old bands, had, like, when we cashed out at the end of the day, I think I came away with £180. God knows how much I pumped into it, but that's what I walked away with at the end. That was what was left in the band's account when we called it a day and closed the account. And Ryan had about 500, 600 quid left or something. Whatever it was, we just chipped in that money ourselves to pay for the press agent to promote the single. And then, management helped with the pressing of the first single. But then it funded itself from then on. The money that the first single kind of generated funded the second one. And then, yes, T-shirts started selling online, and we were selling T-shirts to America and stuff in the lockdown. And it was like, what? I couldn't believe it. I remember buying 100. We had 50 T-shirts and they all went. And then we bought 150. And I remember that was one time when me and Ryan had a slight argument. He was like, this is a waste of money. These aren't going to sell. And I was like, have faith, they'll sell. And we put them online and like they all went. And it was like that money like funded the next stage. And it was just like, it's impossible to do it without money. But for some reason, maybe just that logo on a T-shirt kind of was bankrolling us a little bit. I don't know. We got lucky.
And were you surprised when America's ears sort of pricked up about it? Because I don't want to put onto these are quite northern stories, but they're certainly quite British stories. And obviously I can hear that they're quite northern stories, but there's some sort of frame of references that they're definitely not going to get.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I feel like that about anywhere in Europe. Like Ryan sort of always says, like, you know, they don't have pound strop terracotta frogs in Germany. Like, maybe they do.
Maybe they do.
Yeah, Euro shop terracotta frugs. I don't know what they're called over there. I wasn't very good at German at school. It's not frug. That's stupid. I mean, at that point, there's always a couple of like Anglophiles and early adopters at college radio and that pick up. So, you know, they're going to places like Seattle and New York. That's not as, you know, surprising. But when American booking agents started getting in touch, we thought they were taking the piss. We were like, how's it going to translate over there? And then it was like, you know, manager was like, no, like, you know, below the mainstream, they quite like British bands. They, you know, there's a bit of an interest in it. So you might do all right, you know, because we were like, we can't tour America. Like, we'll just lose loads of money. He's like, yeah, you will, but you should give it a go because it's an experience. And then at the end of the day, if they don't want you, you won't go back.
Yeah.
And it was like, so we may as well make this once in a lifetime, like, have a go. But then in all the time this happened, obviously, like, Republic in America picked us up, which is, like, fucking Taylor Swift and Stevie Wonder is on Republic. I don't know what.
Wow.
R&R out there does us and Eddie Vedder.
What?
So, like, fuck knows what this. But, like, you know, like, you take it all with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous. But, yeah, I mean, like, went on Jimmy Fallon. What the fuck was that about? Like, he's stupid.
How was that?
Yeah, really funny. Like, we just, I don't know. Like I say, we've all been around the block. We've all been doing it long enough. Everything that happens now is just a hilarious bonus.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, it's like, I mean, we take it seriously, but at the same time, we do take it with a pinch of salt.
I think you have to, though, don't you?
You can't be serious about that.
It's the same in my game.
Yeah. It's a really funny thing trying to balance like that, because, I mean, it's like, what are your core, like, what do you want to be and what are your core beliefs? Like, you know, America in itself has an image that goes largely against what I think I'm about, you know. And so far I feel like I've not been suckered into it, you know. I'm not bothered about status and financial status, and I'm not bothered about rubbing shoulders with. I'm bothered about it because it's funny.
Yeah.
Like, I'm bothered about like getting a photo with Jimmy Fallon because it's funny to show to my mates. But I'm not bothered in like trying to make friends with people unless they become my friends over time. And, you know, that's not going to happen in that moment. And it can be quite a like vapid and world you can get sucked into if you have you been in America? Have you like have you been out?
No.
Not have any auditions out? Because I listened to this one with Martin Compton.
Oh yeah.
And when he was talking about his LA fiasco and that, I just thought like you've not been out there, not done any auditions or out.
No, I was we lived in New York when I was married, because my ex-wife was on Broadway at the
time.
Right, okay. So I went over with the cat.
Nice.
Because we're going to be there for like 6 months.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do it out, but I did some auditions.
For Broadway or for film or TV?
For film and telly.
Right.
But I just thought, well, I'm trying to build a career over here.
Yeah.
And, you know, touch wood, I'm grafting, I'm working hard and it's going all right. So
yeah.
I don't want to start again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what I'd be doing.
I mean, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
We go out there, the venues are 200 cappers again, you know. It was quite a jolt going from, like, playing to 200 to coming back and playing to, like, 1,000 in London. But I like the rush of that. I like it. Keeps you on your toes. It means you don't get into that monotony. Like you say, a festival crowd's not your own, a sport crowd's not your own. You go to Europe or you go to America and all the venues are different sizes, and then you come back and you can play to, you know, I mean, yeah, about 1,000 odd people a night now for us. And it's like, that's all like ace. But then, like, yeah, it's good because it keeps you in check and it reminds you that you're not the be-all and end-all.
Well, it's things like that that ground you.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
Which are really important.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it must be important to a lot of people. I don't know. I like to see the best in people, but it's important to me. Yeah. I like to try, yeah. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, so America was funny, but we just had a good time with it. But, yeah, they really went for it. And the funny thing about America was, We had a friend who, I will just name him because they're a mate and it's fine, but it was Ali who produced our album. He kind of said, like, just like word of advice when you go over there, he was like, don't try all like the sarcastic, like piss taking that you do, because they just won't get it. And, like, and you know, it'll go again. And, you know, he didn't say that in as many words, but he was kind of implying like that won't really
hit
the spot over there. And he was kind of maybe being a little bit careerist, like a little bit like, you know, maybe just, you know, think about like playing the game over there a bit. Like, maybe I'm projecting a little bit because he didn't say those words, but that kind of felt like what he was saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there, and, you know, I love Ali. Ali's amazing. Like, but that's kind of what he said. And we just fucking doubled down on it, you know. Just completely took the piss. And just did not acknowledge that we were grateful to be in America. But then we'd pull it back and say that we were. And then we'd like, you know.
How did it go down?
They love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's insulting to Americans to say that they're not capable of getting sarcasm and like dry humour.
They love British humour.
Yeah, exactly.
The amount of American actors that I know that fucking just have a diet of British comedies, that's all they want.
I mean, I guess this is like, though, again, this is like, you know, college towns and the coasts, like, you know, liberal cities that are, you know, maybe their culture extends to kind of like British sitcoms and stuff, so maybe that, you know, maybe if we hit, like, you know, we were going to do some support slots with quite a big band, and you know, it would have been hitting like middle, you know, like 10,000 seaters in normal towns, and like fuck knows how I'd act in front of a stadium of middle American fans would have gone down, but you know. That's not happening. But for the time being, people are buying tickets to our show because they get what we're about.
Yeah.
We're not being, I mean, I guess apart from Jimmy Fallon, we're not really being exposed to in places that wouldn't already understand what we're about. So I think maybe it's not as big a thing over there at the moment. But I mean, playing Coachella was weird.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean,
why?
Well, just because it's kind of like a sort of like influencer haven, innit? And again, it was like, you know, mate, you know, it's like K-pop bands and Megan Thee Stallion and Billie Eilish and, you know, Rina Sawayama and loads of other stuff, but, you know, major pop acts and then us fucking about. And it was so stupid. It was just really silly. But, yeah, you know, we only had half hour set there, so it was just like, yeah, prancing around, just, I don't know. I don't really know what's going on. I'm just kind of enjoying it.
I think you should just carry on enjoying it. Yeah. James, this has been brilliant. I feel we've got so much more to talk about. Maybe we should do this again in a year and see where we're all at in a year's time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. See if the venues are smaller or bigger in America.
This has been brilliant. Thanks so much, man.
No, cheers, Craig. Really
enjoyed
that.
Enjoy your Glastonbury.
Yeah, see you there.
Nice to see you there.
Yeah, class. Nice one, mate.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? You know how I've always said about this podcast over the years? It's about sitting down and getting to know somebody and just seeing what clicks. Sometimes things fly better than others. And I think this is a true representation of certainly what we set out to do, is get to know somebody. And you know what? Maybe it'll click. And you know, this really did. It really did. I met up with James and met his lovely wife and friends at Glastonbury, and his friend, fellow musician, Katie J. Pearson, who I saw on the park stage. She's brilliant. Go check out Katie J. Pearson's music. I believe I'm right in saying she's a Bristol-based musician. Anyway, doesn't matter where she's from. She's fantastic. And yeah, we all had a fantastic first Glastonbury. So I think we'll probably just go back there next year and do it all again. Yard Act are on tour now. They've been supporting Jack White and Foles. Incredible bands. Go check them out. Myself and past guest John Sim will be in Brighton seeing Yard Act in November. So if you're there, come say hello. But yeah, check them out if you can live. They are something else. James's energy, the band's energy, they're not taking any prisoners. I love it. So what are we going to do next week? I don't know. I really don't know. Because I haven't recorded it yet. I'm busy filming this new series, but I'm going to get on it. We will have something for next week. I will not let you down. Do not panic. Pass this episode over to other people who may not know Yard Act, may not know James, may not know the podcast. Maybe they'll like it. We'll be back with you next week. I don't know what it'll be. We'll be back. Right, I'm going to go to bed. Because I'm shattered. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. You know it means a lot. You know where we are. We're on the socials. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I don't even need to say that anymore, do I? You know where we are. Hit us up with messages. If you enjoyed it, do let us know. Right. I want to go for a bit of a soak and a bath. No, just a soak. And then straight to bed. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson. Recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Valor. Cheers. Bye.